nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
All right, so today we start considering a very important topic, actually, which has to do with photonic crystals. There are two pioneers of this field, who are Ilya Yablonovich from UCLA and Sajiv John from University of Toronto. The beauty of this nanophotonics area that all these people are around. I mean, I meet both of them at least 3-4 times a year. And that's kind of interesting that when you know people who pioneered a new field, and many believe there will be a Nobel Prize eventually in this area because it's a very, very important discovery, photonic crystals with a potentially huge impact on the area of photonics. So by saying all this, I want you to realize and live with the idea that it's not like special people do difference in science. People like you make a difference in science, and you might be one of those who would do this beautiful discovery like the one we're going to consider now. It was done only, well, on my scale, it's recently, only 19 years ago. For you, it perhaps long ago, but anyway, so all these things are happening right now. It's still a very vivid field, which develops a lot with every year new beautiful contributions coming to this very exciting field. It has to do with periodical structures made of typically of dielectric material, although people also speak of plasmonic photonic crystals or even polaritonic photonic crystals. But in most usual case, that's a dielectric which arranged in a periodical fashion. So that it actually acts pretty much like a diffraction grating. And that's why it has these unique properties, because if you have a periodical structure with a period matching the wavelengths, then the interaction with light becomes particularly efficient because of different interference effects, constructive and destructive, and very strong and unusual phenomena can occur. Well, the very simple idea to imagine, to think of these objects, is just to look at this structure and generalize it for all possible ways to build a photonic crystal. So this is clearly 1D periodical structure. So you basically have a stack of layers, and you can clearly see periodicity. So this is 2D periodic structure. So you could say that this is 1D photonic crystals. This is 2D, two-dimensional photonic crystals. And finally, in this case, you have three-dimensional periodical structure. And photonic crystals often call semiconductors for light. And that's for a good reason, because they are as important as semiconductors in the case of electronics. They also have band structure. They also have a band gap, but not for electrons, but for photons. And therefore, you can manipulate photons in a very similar way you manipulate electrons with semiconductors. So it's a fully justified name, actually, for photonic crystals, semiconductors for light. Because if you look at photonic modes in a photonic crystal, they are very, very similar, actually almost like one-to-one correspondence to electronic modes in the case of semiconductor. The only drawback, if you can call it a drawback, related to photonic crystals is the fact that they're basically well-suited for microphotonics rather than nanophotonics. And the reason for that, the latest period has to be related to the wavelengths, because that's the way they work. They work as a diffraction gradient, as I said. Therefore, essentially, it's a microphotonic structure, because the wavelengths of light in the visible is half a micron. So, or let's say submicron photonics, but not true nanophotonics. Simply because, as I said, the latest period is not in nanoscale, but rather it is on the micron scale to match the wavelengths of light. But microphotonics is also good. And if you really want to do something on the micron scale, on a submicron scale, that's probably the way to go. Because photonic crystals really could do miracle in terms of manipulating light on micron scale.
So, question?
Yep.
So just according to what you say, when we conclude collide is any nanostructure to emitting light or...
So, but that's the biggest challenge, and as I said in introduction to this course, that's the biggest challenge of nanophotonics, how you can efficiently couple light, which is submicron scale, half a micron, to nanostructures. And that's going to be the second part of our course. And the keyword here will be metal, plasmons. Those structures allow to efficiently couple to light, despite the fact they are much smaller, one to orders of magnitude smaller than the wavelengths, but they do the job, as opposed to photonic crystals.
When you say couple to light, is it the absorption aspect or the emission aspect, or is it both? Because they have papers on efficient light emission from nanowires and all these nanostructures.
It includes both, but it's not limited to this. It's more than that. Of course, if you have strong absorption and emission, it does imply that there is strong coupling, but there is more into this. But if you let me first continue with this, and we will come back to what I mean by strong coupling. When we will come really to this part of the course. Okay. As opposed to other structures which we'll consider later in the course, such as metamaterials, which do not exist in nature, in the case with photonic crystals, when they were discovered and their properties were explained and understood to some extent, people realized there are plenty examples in nature objects, actually, living objects, which based on photonic crystals, which actually employ some properties of photonic crystals, such as, for example, this sea mouse. This guy, Nikolai, actually, is also a good friend of mine who lives in Sydney, and he wrote a book, basically, about this numerous structures and organisms in nature which use these photonic crystal structures for various purposes. In the case of the sea mouse, you have these absolutely beautiful colors. And that's all related to the fact that that the structure of this hair actually looks like a periodical structure of some structural units. You see, it is actually photonic crystals because you clearly can see periodicity here. It would not go into details how exactly it works, but the point here that the beautiful colors associated with these creatures are directly related to the photonic crystal-like structure of hair of these organisms. And here are the pioneers whom I both mentioned, Eli Oblanovich and Sergey John. So they actually published in the same issue of Physical Review Letters in 87 two articles, which look absolutely different. They're on two different subjects. But in both cases, enabling tool to realize the ideas which these two authors discussed in their papers were based on photonic crystals. Eli Blanovich was speaking in his pioneering paper of possible control of the very fundamental things, such as a spontaneous emission. People believed for a long time that spontaneous emission is something you cannot touch, you cannot control, you cannot modify, because it's related to interaction with vacuum, electromagnetic vacuum. It turns out if your atom is sitting in a cavity, and in this particular case, Eli Blanovich was speaking of a cavity formed by a defect in photonic crystals. So if you have a photonic crystal, as we will see in a moment, you have a band gap, energy gap. So it means that for this particular energies, photonic modes cannot exist. However, if you create a defect in photonic crystals, within that defect, photonic mode can exist. So as soon as it goes outside of the defect, it cannot propagate because it's in the energy gap. So, but inside of the defect, it can exist. So it works as a cavity. Light is confined there. And when you place atom inside of this cavity, it turns out you can control spontaneous emission. For example, you can make spontaneous emission completely inhibited for all frequencies except the one where you have laziness. It's a beautiful idea, and people actually did lots of experiments along these lines. And Sajjeev John showed that such unique phenomenon as localization of light, which is truly very fundamental property, which still has not been unambiguously experimentally observed. But he indicated, again, if you take a photonic crystal and just only slightly introduce a small degree of disorder, then the conditions for observation of this unique phenomenon called localization of light, when light is trapped in a very small area of the order of the wavelengths because of multiple scattering, can be much easier obtained in the case of photonic crystals. So both we are speaking of actually two different physical phenomena, but both suggested as unique means to realize those phenomena photonic crystals. And that was the beginning. After that, Eli Blanovich actually designed and fabricated one of the first photonic crystals in the microwave, and the race started. People still very actively work in this field. This is just one of the examples of kind of simple photonic crystal, which is one-dimensional photonic crystal. You see that periodical stack of layers, but they arrange in a cylindrical way. And it turns out that this structure works as omnidirectional reflector. Omnidirectional means for any reflection, for any angle of incidence, it would reflect, as opposed to conventional mirror that has certain limitation. And this particular structure actually already used for treating various diseases. And this guy, whom again I know very well, Young Fink from MIT originally, he has now his own company making big, big dollars. But basically using this idea of photonic crystals, which they apply right now in medicine. Unfortunately, I should say it's only one, perhaps two or three applications of photonic crystals which are already used in the industry, but this is a spectacular one. It usually takes quite a bit of time when big discoveries, even this like photonic crystals, find their ways into industry. So this is just review. I mean, you're not expected to understand details. It's just review, like, what kind of unusual things you can have with photonic crystal. Then we would look in detail how they operate, what is the physics behind them. So again, if you have a periodical structure like this one, as I told you, if the frequency of light is such that electromagnetic mode cannot exist, cannot propagate, meaning that frequency of your photon is exactly in the energy gap, so then actually light cannot propagate through this structure. However, if you make a defect, in this case you see it's like waveguide type, linear type defect, that along this defect, light can propagate. So it starts working as a waveguide. But instead of, let's say, metallic or whatever other sidewalls of this waveguide, you basically have a photonic crystal. So light cannot go outside of this waveguide because the frequency is within the energy gap. Therefore, it remains confined within the defect. So by changing the shape of your defect, you actually can guide light along different type of path. So in this case, you see, with normal waveguide, when you have a sharp angle like here, 90 degrees actually, not sharp, but let's say strong change in direction, then you would have very strong losses. In principle, in photonic crystals, you can minimize these losses, bring it to the level when there are nearly no losses. So potentially, this type of waveguides based on photonic crystals. And remember that the key thing about photonic crystals is interference. And as you will see later, basically Bragg reflection. Because of the Bragg reflection, because of the interference provided by this periodicity, you have these energy gaps, you have this confinement within these defects, and you have this all unusual properties. I mentioned one application, these omnidirectional reflectors. Another one is, of course, crystal fibers, photonic crystal fibers, which were invented by Philip Russell, the guy from UK who visited us three times here in Purdue. Some of you perhaps saw his presentation. So the idea here again, if you have, let's say, a hole within a photonic crystal fiber, so it turns out that works as a defect, and you can confine light within this defect, and it propagates along this defect, and it stays confined. It's the opposite to the case of conventional fiber, when usually you have a curve is largely refractive index. In this case, you actually have a hole. If you would introduce any effective refractive index, clearly that there cannot be total internal reflection, which guides in the case of conventional Faber. Here, the situation is reversed, but you still keep light confined within the core. And the physics behind this guiding is actually related to the photonic crystal effect, to this Bragg reflection interference, which I was talking about. This is a beautiful photonic crystals fabricated by Yuri Vlasov, my friend from IBM. Look how it's beautiful. The period, it's based on so-called inverse opal, and the beauty of this structure is undeniable. It's really fantastic. Xiaomin Lin from Sandia made this stack of periodical structures, which is also looks very nice. And all these photonic crystals, they usually result in, I mean, beautiful structures like this result in publications in Nature, Science, because it's extremely important to fabricate such wonderful structures because of their very important applications. So I already mentioned conventional fibers, and where the change in refractive index between the core and cladding is relatively small on the scale of percent, or few percent. In the case of photonic crystal structures, you could make the change in refractive index, which we call optical contrast, very large, 100%. Because, let's say, the structural unit could be based on some dielectric or semiconductor, whereas, let's say, the surrounding host could be air, for example. You can easily make the change in refractive index 100% or so at that scale, which is important. In this case, you can have very very interesting phenomena and very large energy gaps, which is critical for a number of applications of photonic crystals. So people say of a new conceptual framework in optics based on photonic crystals, because in this, again, in the same fashion as introduction of semiconductors was revolutionary for electronics, introduction of photonic crystals was pretty much played the same role for microphotonics and nanophotonics. So, and there are many common things such as band structure concepts. So with similar, we have band structure concept for electrons and semiconductors. In this case, we have band structure for photonic modes, for electromagnetic modes. So I already said that photonic crystals in that sense can be thought of as, and with full justification, as semiconductors for light. So this is a classical example of photonic crystal, when you could take these cylinders, rods, made of high-index dielectric material, such as, for example, silicon or gallium arsenide semiconductor materials, and place them in air with periodicity related to 1.5 micron. In this case, you can make operate the structure as a very efficient means for controlling light at the telecommunication wavelengths, 1.5 micron, which of course has very, very important applications. I mentioned Yuri Vlasov a couple slides ago from IBM. The reason IBM actually wants to have someone like him, because they really want to integrate it with silicon electronics, and by using the same silicon platform, introduce photonic chips, microphotonic chips, and integrate it with electronics, and that all related to optical communications. So they, of course, interested exclusively in 1.5 micron, because eventually you want to send your information to the outside world. And for this, nothing can be better than fibers, and fibers work at 1.5 microns. So IBM seriously believes, and they already demonstrated a number of very important effects, that silicon-based nanophotonics, which is built on the idea of photonic crystals, can be integrated with silicon electronics. And that's many believe is the nearest future, because that's the way to speed up the processing of information, because you can process information with photons by much faster. You don't have these RC delays, which limit electronics to roughly 110 gigahertz operational rate. With photonics, it can be 2-3 orders of magnitude higher, the operational speed. And that's one of the basic advantages of this microphotonics based on photonic crystals.
Yes.
Say
it again.
Do you have any comment or opinion about the use of Satan as a target tree?
I don't understand your question.
Okay. So you say another advantage to use a second to be a photonic.
Right.
Do you have any opinion?
Any what?
Opinion. Yeah.
Specific? Well, so the basic advantage here is electronics is fundamentally limited in terms of operational speed because of RC delay. It's unavoidable. And when you start to see what is the highest speed can be accomplished with silicon electronics, silicon-based electronics, it goes to, 10 gigahertz, perhaps 100 gigahertz, and that's it. You cannot process information faster than that. In the case of light, the rate with which you can process information is limited only by the frequency of light, fundamental frequency of light, which is 10 to the 15, meaning that it's two orders or three orders of magnitude higher operational speed. And there is nothing more important in all processing information than the speed with which you process information. Therefore, basically, you cannot beat light. Light is the fastest way, the fastest means to process information. And sooner or later, anyway, it will be done with light. On the other hand, people try to be realistic. Billions and billions of dollars invested in silicon electronics, and lots of things are done beautifully with silicon electronics. Therefore, the best way to proceed, at least in the near future, to integrate the two technologies, silicon electronics and nanophotonics.
But what is the big challenge for that?
The big what?
Big challenge.
Challenge. The challenge is integration. It's easy to control electrons. You apply the field, electrons have charge, so they move in any direction you want. It's much harder to control photons. For example, you would need to have things like optical transistors, which, again, it's easy to do with electrons, how you would do it with photons. There are good ideas, but it's not that easy. And also, again, the other problem is, when you bring photon into the game, you unavoidably bring very big scale related to the wavelengths. How to squeeze light down to nanoscale, because you want to have your devices as small as possible. With electronics, it's not a problem. Because in that case, we already integrated it to the scale down to 10 nanometers. That's the nowadays electronics. But with photonics, it's not easy, because you have this huge mismatch. That's the challenge. So size mismatch, fundamental problem, and also how you can convert electrical signal to optical and the other way around, that's also another problem. There are lots of problems to solve there.
What about light absorption by the semiconductors? Are we working at energies that are within the band gap?
So the thing is, when you speak of integration of electronics and photonics, you would like, for example, to electrically pump something and then convert it to light, or the other way around. And unfortunately, silicon, which is the semiconductor for electronics, is indirect material, and therefore it doesn't like to emit or absorb light. So that's the biggest problem. If silicon would be direct material, so in that case, that would be just ideal situation for integrating optics and electronics. But what you mentioned, absorption light, that's a critical. We would like to easy convert between electronics and photonics through basically this channel. Like you absorb a photon, convert it to electrical signal, or the other way around. You apply voltage and you convert it to, you create some electron hole pairs and convert it to photons. That's all those challenges we are talking about.
In your previous slide, you actually built your photonic crystal out of semiconductors. So, and you actually had gallium arsenide there too.
Right, that's the problem. Gallium arsenide is great for photonics, but it's not the material of electronics. That's the problem. I mentioned both silicon and gallium arsenide, but that's a big difference. Gallium arsenide works for photonics, but it's not that attractive for electronics, and the opposite true about silicon. So therefore, nowadays science and engineering is so much actually material science. It's all about materials, creating materials with new properties. Okay, so here you can see the photonic structure actually. of a crystal, photonic crystal, periodic Lagrange photonic crystal, such as we considered, let's say, periodic array of roads. And you're probably familiar with this. So there is this gamma point, X point, and M point. So basically it gives you the direction, let's say, along X, Y, and along the diagonal, if you wish. So, and that's the way the dependence, the frequency versus wave vector looks like. We call it dispersion relation. So for this gamma X direction, it starts from zero, increases, then it goes like this, and then it decreases when you come back to the gamma point. But the next bend, you see there is a gap in between, means that if you have a photon with frequency within this range, those electromagnetic modes cannot propagate through the crystal. And that's the beauty of this. Since they cannot propagate through the crystal, now you can make defects and create cavities, waveguides, where light would be confined. Because within defects, where basically it's not a photonic crystals, you can have this electromagnetic mode. But as soon as it will goes outside of the defect, then it cannot propagate. So you confine light within defects, and that's the way to create these fancy waveguides, cavities, and that's the way to manipulate and control light.
And what about the speed of this propagation? That should be related to the gradient of that.
Right. Actually, I pointed out here these two points, for example, the speed, the group velocity, which characterizes speed with which these modes propagate is d omega over dk. And you can see that you can control this speed very strongly depending on which point of the k space you're located. For example, at these two particular points, the group velocity is zero because the derivative is zero. And the biggest application of photonic crystals, as often happens when new things come, they are unfortunately oversold. There is too much hype about that. At some point, people believe that nearly any problem in photonics can be solved in photonic crystals. Turns out to be not the case. Although in principle, this is true, but there are always easier ways to do it, cheaper ways to do it. Therefore, things like waveguiding, cavities, although photonic crystals are wonderful, there are still better ways to do it. But one thing where photonic crystals are absolutely unbeatable is the dispersion control. Because you can make this dispersion dependence, omega as a function of k, anything you want. You basically really can completely control dispersion, which is unthinkable with any nature-existing materials exist in nature. So this unparalleled control of dispersion, that's what makes photonic crystals absolutely unique and unbeatable. So that's what people believe now, that when it comes down to control of dispersion, there is no better material than photonic crystals. And in particular, can make group velocity equal to zero, easily to make it equal to zero. Well, a little bit mathematics, how we describe them. So this is familiar to us, Maxwell's equation. Let's focus in these two, the two curl equations. So a circle of H is equal to dd over dt. And circle of E is equal to dB over dt. So we assume there is no current, no free charges, so J is equal to zero, and no magnetism, mu is equal to one. Magnetic permeability is equal to one. So if we now use this harmonic mode representation for H, for the magnetic field, and for E, the electrical field, then these two equations acquire this form. Okay, the next step, let's express E from this equation, from the upper equation, and substitute it in the second equation for E. Clearly, you would have here double circle of E, right? Because you have here circle E, and if I use for E expression through circle of H, you would get double circle of H, so which will bring you to this type of equation. And the important thing, and now I introduce C, which is a 1 over square root of epsilon naught times mu naught. The important thing of this equation, this is, looks as a typical equation so-called for eigenfunction, eigennumbers. So that's really, really a key thing. So in this form, H, which is the magnetic field representing these electromagnetic modes, is an eigenfunction of this equation with the operator given by this expression. It's written here, operator theta. Okay, So that's what I wrote here in words. The Maxwell's equation for the steady state in this case can be expressed in terms of the eigenvalue problem in the same way as we do it in quantum mechanics. When we describe electrons in solids and semiconductors, that's the way we do it. And this is, as I point out here, in direct analogy to quantum mechanics that governs the property of electrons. So we have very similar situation. In the case of quantum mechanics, when we describe electrons in solids, we use this wave function. Okay, now we are speaking of the magnetic field. Okay, so this is plays the role of the wave function in the case of electronics. In the case of, again, electronics, we introduce Hamiltonian, and Hamiltonian has this form. This is operator of kinetic energy and the operator of potential energy. In our case, the operator which governs the property of these electromagnetic modes is given by this double circle operator, and it also depends on the dielectric permittivity. So you see there is one-to-one correspondence between these two problems. In both cases, we have bands, energy bands, in the case of solids for electrons, in the case of electronics, sorry, and here for electromagnetic modes. But mathematically, in both cases, it's just solving this eigenvalue problem with just slightly different operators. This operator theta plays the same role as Hamiltonian in the case of electronics. So it's a play as fundamental as Hamiltonian in the case of conventional electronics related to semiconductors, for example. So this is our master equation, okay, with this operator. Let's do a little bit mathematics. I could go into more details, but I would have to use a blackboard, and it cannot be actually picked by the camera. Therefore, I ask you to do it. It's just like homework exercise. It's not that difficult. So let's introduce so-called inner product, or as we call it, scalar product in Hermitian space. So by this scalar product, we mean actually this integral of these two functions. Let's say inner product of function f and g, they are both functions, so is given by this integral, by definition. And the function which goes first comes with this complex conjugation. Okay, so that's just the way we define this inner product. And then operator is called Hermitian if you can move operator from this position to this one. If the inner product doesn't depend on where this operator stands, or let's say on which function this operator acts, and on the function which stands in the second position, or on the function which stands on the first position, if the result is the same, this operator is called Hermitian, and that has lots of important consequences. And to prove that this operator, particular operator we are talking about, is actually Hermitian, you have to do this integration, and the two tricks you're supposed to use is you integrate it by parts and you use the Gauss theorem. You go from the volume integral to the surface integral, and you assume that fields at the infinite surface are zero, so and integrate by parts, and it's pretty much straightforward, perhaps 2-3 minutes exercise, and you can show that this particular operator under consideration is indeed Hermitian, and that has very important consequences. As I said, two tricks to play is integrating by parts and using the Gauss theorem. All right, and so as soon as you prove it, that important property, so then we could write down that when operator theta acts on the field distribution, magnetic field distribution, so the eigenvalue problem acquires this form with eigennumbers given by omega over c squared, where omega is the frequency of electromagnetic mode. So first of all, by taking into account that this operator is Hermitian, you can easily prove that omega squared is real number here, that it really has the sense of frequency. So it is real number. That's really important here. Because the way to prove it, when theta acts at h, you get this omega over c squared. That's what I did. On the other hand, since it's Hermitian, I could place this operator theta not in this position, but in this position. However, when I put it in this position, then I have to remember that it goes with complex conjugation. Then I have to put here a complex conjugation sign. So then you have that this is equal to this, which is true only under the condition that omega is real. Okay? Since operator is Hermitian, this is equal to this, but from this immediately follows that omega has to be equal to omega star, which means that omega is real. In the same way, you can prove that omega squared is a positive number. The thing is to note that when you consider this combination, h, inner product of h and theta h, it can be written as this. Again, that's very easy to prove by using integration by parts. So, but this is obviously a positively defined quantity. In other words, it's positive because it involves modulus squared, so from which we conclude that omega is real and positive. A very, very important property, which again related to the fact that operator theta is Hermitian, that any two eigenfunctions which have different eigennumbers are orthonormal, meaning that the inner product for them is equal to zero. So that's easy to prove. For those who didn't take quantum mechanics and also some basics of algebra, it might be a little bit challenging, but it's okay. I mean, if you, it's a challenge for you, even if you don't understand this particular mathematics, it would not preclude you from understanding all other material. For those who did take quantum mechanics or some related mathematics behind it, that should be a very common thing. So my point here, if you don't follow in all details this consideration, don't be upset because you still could follow the rest of the course even without understanding this mathematics. So it's very basic. It's not that challenging, but provided that you know some fundamentals behind that. So let's prove that these two functions actually are orthogonal. So if you take, let's consider this inner product of H2 and H1. And when you act with operator theta on H1, you get this combination. On the other hand, because it's Hermitian operator, again, I can move this operator from this position to this one. But that means that it's equal to omega 2 over c squared. You see, now you have combination. This is the same integral, but here we have omega 1 squared, here's omega 2 squared. And since these two frequencies are different, we're considering two different eigennumbers, that can be true only if the inner product of H2 and H1 is equal to zero. And that's what we call orthogonal functions. So two different eigenfunctions are orthogonal each other. So meaning that when you take a product of the two and integrate it over the space, you get zero, which of course implied that this function have to change sign all the time. So, but that's very, very important property. So the electromagnetic field actually represents eigenfunction of this operator theta, and the different eigenfunction actually orthogonal in the same way as wave functions in the case of quantum mechanics belonging to different states also orthogonal. And that's the consequence of the fact that that the Hamiltonian is Hermitian operator. So, and that's true actually for any Hermitian operator. So this is just an example of these orthogonal states. And for example, if you take sine type of function, so in this case, if you consider, for example, the product of this function for this state and this state, clearly when you multiply these two functions and integrate it over the space, you would get the result of zero because this is multiplied by some positive function and this is multiplied by the same in magnitude but negative function. So when you integrate, the total result would be zero. And that's true about any two functions. They're all orthogonal to each other. So that's what we mean that different modes are orthogonal, and that's the consequence of the fact that this operator theta is actually a Hermitian operator. Well, it also indicates that this function have to change sign. They kind of should be varying in space because otherwise it wouldn't be possible. And also, since this operator contains derivatives with respect to the field, it's clearly that high-frequency mode tend to have more special variation in their field patterns, as you can see here. This is the basic mode, the ground state. Here you have, let's say, one node, two nodes, one, two, three nodes, and so on. So the higher mode you consider, the more various in space that mode. So it's very, very similar to electronic states in quantum mechanics. Same story, that's the basic. Therefore, photonic crystals are semiconductors for light. A very important property is scale invariance. What it means is the following. If you simply change the scale, if you let's say, change R by R divided by S, let's say, compress the space, then everything, all the field distribution, everything would be the same if you just correspondingly change all the important parameters. What I mean by this is the following. Let's say I have originally photonic crystals with this period A and the wavelengths lambda, and this is the field distribution. Well, this is some maxima and minima. If now I multiplied lambda and A by the same factor, then everything would be the same. It's just like basically you do scale transformation. You look at with microscope with a stronger resolution, let's say. So, but the field distribution is exactly the same. That's what called scale invariance. So the problem doesn't change mathematically if you compress the space. If you go, for example, from R to S times R, then the equation remains the same in terms of this new variable R prime. That's the physics, that's the mathematics and physics behind this. So in other words, if you solve the problem, what physical properties depends basically, it's not on the ratio of A over lambda. So if you do photonic crystals for, let's say, for one wavelength, you can have another photonic crystals with a different period, latest period, which would have absolutely the same physical properties for the different wavelengths. The problem scales with the size of this system. That's very important. So which allows us to introduce some frequency, which is C over A, where A is the latest period, angular frequency, same thing, but multiplied it by 2 pi, wave vector, which is 2 pi over A again, the latest of period, and some wavelengths, which is simply A, the latest period. Let me illustrate this idea of scale invariance, or the fact that we can use normalized units. For example, let's consider this particular structure of, let's say, cylindrical rods placed in air. And let's say we have a gap, energy gap, which extends from 0.2837 Ca to 0.4183 Ca, so that the mid-gap frequency is 0.3510. And now we want to design a crystal which has such that 1.55 micron telecommunication wave length falls exactly the center of the gap. What should be the period of this photonic crystal? The question. So the way we do it, we substitute for A, because you see A is our wavelengths. This exactly wavelengths of interest, which is 1.55. And then you would obtain, when you divide C by 1.55 micron, you would get 0.3510 Ca. And therefore, A, you can find from this equation, is equal 0.544 micron. So you see, that's exactly what I said. Let's say I want to have a photonic crystal with a gap which has the central frequency exactly corresponding to 1.55 micron, then I substitute for A this particular wavelength, and I immediately find what should be the period of that photonic crystal to have this happen. So in other words, the problem is actually can be described in terms of these normalized units. The physical properties scale for different sizes. That's a very convenient property. All right, another thing to note is the following. This variational principle, I left it in the end of this lecture. I'm not going to go through this. It's, again, a little bit too mathematical. I leave it up to you. It's like your homework assignment. The very last two slides in this presentation illustrate this variational principle. But let's rather just in very general terms, qualitatively consider the idea behind that, because it's actually easy. So when operator theta acts on the magnetic field, so as we know, we obtain this eigennumber omega over c squared times h. So now let's multiply both sides of this equation by h star and integrate. Okay, then here I would obtain, when I multiply by h star and integrate, I would obtain this integral. So, and I normalize it here. And on the left-hand side of the equation, I would get h star theta h integral of that. And we already know that can be written like this. Where it was? Here.
You see, that's equal. When you take h, theta h, it's given by this integral. That's exactly what I did here. Okay, so then when I multiply again by h star and integrate over the space, or in other words, when I take inner product for both sides of this equation, so I would obtain this on the left-hand side of the equation and this on the right-hand side of the equation. So eventually I can express omega over c as this ratio. Now let's pay attention to the fact that circle of h is what? Is dd over dt, where d is the displacement current, right? And dd over dt is simply just omega times d. So what I have here is d squared over epsilon and omega. Well, omega is not important here. So now let's see, when frequency, which describe this frequency of these eigenmodes, would be less. I have here d divided by epsilon, d squared divided by epsilon. Clearly, to minimize frequency, if d is concentrated, if large d is concentrated in the areas where epsilon is also large, then overall integral would be less. Then large d would be in the areas where epsilon is small, okay? Because we consider the ratio of the two, which means that the smaller frequencies occur in the case when the displacement field is concentrated in the area of high epsilon. The reason I'm mentioning all this, we have these different bands, okay, the lower band and the upper band. This lower band typically is called dielectric band, whereas the upper band is called air band. Let's assume that we have a photonic crystals built of, let's say, these rods with high epsilon and air. So why we call this band dielectric band and this air band? Because for lower band, when frequency is low, d is concentrated in the areas where epsilon is large. In other words, within the dielectric. So when the displacement field is concentrated within the dielectric, you have a smaller frequency, which corresponds to this lower band. When the displacement field is concentrated in the areas where epsilon is small, clearly this integral will be larger, the frequency would be larger. Then you had the other band, which is called air band. What physically it means, so there are different type of modes, those which have large field within the dielectric, and that typically corresponds to this lower band, and the modes which have large field between the dielectric rods in air, and that typically corresponds to this band. Okay, it's of course qualitative, it's not exact consideration. The exact one is in the end, which is, I call this variational principle. But it gives you a feeling. So this low band typically corresponds to such electromagnetic mode which has tendency to concentrate high fields within the dielectric rather than within the gaps between dielectric. That band we called air band, and that typically has larger frequency. So it's simply like d divided by epsilon. And when you integrate over the space, clearly when d is large in the same areas where epsilon is large, then the ratio is, would not be that large, and the integral will be smaller. If d would be large in the area where epsilon is small, then the integral would be larger, and the frequency would be larger. Therefore, you would jump to the upper band. Okay? That's qualitative explanation. So, but that's very common now. That's called dielectric band. That's called air band. Implying where the highest field is concentrated, within the dielectric or in between. Well, let's consider a simple example of these band gaps. And let's consider simply a free space. Okay, in free space, we know, let's say, epsilon and mu are equal 1, and h can be presented just like a plane wave in this way, all right? So, and we know that in this case, dot product of k and h is equal 0, meaning that it's a plane wave, k is perpendicular to h. And the frequency in this case is just simply c times k. It's well-known things for plane waves. If we now plot omega as a function of k, it's just simply these two straight lines. All right, in a free space, it also could be considered as a special type of photonic crystal. Okay, it also has this translational invariance. So in the free space, omega is simply ck, we have these two lines. This is our dispersion relation in the simplest case of free space. Okay, if now we consider not one-dimensional but two-dimensional system, okay, then omega related to k is through this formula.
omega c square root of kx squared plus ky squared. Okay, this is just two-dimensional system. This function depicts basically a cone. If you now plot it in the omega as a function kx and ky, it would have this cone-type structure. You could also look at the projection, and if you look at the projection in kx, ky plane, you would have these circles, okay, concentric circles. So, but let's now do it in the way we did it for photonic crystal. Let's remember there was this point gamma x m. Remember this gamma x m. So when you go from gamma to x, you move along x direction. When you go from x to m, you move along y direction. So let's we start from the origin when both are equal zero. And then now we move along the x direction. Ky remains zero, but kx increases. So then, of course, you would have this linear dependence. Omega is just equal ckx. So that's the when you move along gamma x direction. Okay, now you reach some maximum gamma, kx. Okay, kx is fixed now, and you move now from x point to m point. Kx is fixed, and ky starts to increase from its zero to some maximum value. What it would happen, it would go like this, because you have here a constant, and this is gradually increases. That would give you this type of dependence. This is when you move from x to m point. And then you move from m point along the diagonal to the zero point. Since you move along the diagonal, it means that kx is equal ky all the time. Basically, your equation becomes omega is equal c k modulus, and it's again a straight line. This is, you see, that's the typical dependence for free space. And if you now look at the one of the previous slides, like this one, you see it's very similar. Gamma x, it's almost like straight line, then it's some kind of curved line, and then almost like straight line. So what I'm saying, it's not accidental that it has this type of shape compared with this one. For two-dimensional space, that's the way this dispersion relation looks like. In a free space, it's simply like this. Of course, if you have not a free space, but a periodical structure, it's somewhat modified, but more or less related to this. That should give you some feeling about this band structure. Very important, so-called Bloch theorem. If you have a periodical structure, then and your operator is Hermitian, then it turns out that any eigenmode, in this case, the field distribution, can be presented in this form as EIKR times the function which is periodic in space with the period exactly equal to the period of your crystal, latest period. Okay, so that's the essence of the Bloch function. Any field distribution, any electromagnetic mode must have this form as EIKR times the function which is a periodic function with the period equal to the latest period. Okay, in free space you would have only this. Okay, like in free space, electrons, for example, is described, wave function is described by simply this exponential term EIKR. However, in a periodical structure, it always modulated by some periodical structure U. That's the essence of. Therefore, we say that any physical excitation of periodical structure is represented by Bloch's function. Like electron excitation, phonon excitation, they all should have this Bloch function structure. K gives you just the wave vector, the momentum, and this periodical structure, the periodical function is very important, which makes difference between, let's say, free electron and electron in periodical structure. Because for free electron, electron in free space, that would be the wave function. However, in crystal, it always multiplied by this periodical function. So electron in the crystal is not the same as electron in the free space. And that's true about any physical excitation. Electromagnetic mode in the free space is not the same as it's in the crystal because of this. Okay, this is just illustrate the point. In the free space, you have this EIKX, where K is the momentum, the wave vector of your physical excitation. Photon, electron, whatever. And U has to be periodical with the period equal to the lattice period. So that any physical excitation, like electromagnetic mode, has to have this type of form. That would give you the momentum
and this gives you the periodical modulation related to this block theorem. That's why it's called block function. Well, let's keep the simple proof of this function. You can look at this if you want. It's simple, but just pure mathematics. And very important thing for the whole course is Bragg scattering. Because the idea of these band gaps, as I mentioned, it comes down to interference. And it comes down to Bragg reflection. And it's so easy to understand why we have these band gaps, energy band gaps in photonic crystals. It's simply because of Bragg reflection. As I said, photonic crystals, in terms of physics, are surprisingly simple. It's just diffractional gratings. And so many interesting applications. It's amazing, actually. Okay, let's consider this one-dimensional situation. There is incident light, EIKX, and it can be reflected from the first layer, which then it would give contribution to the reflected wave R, the reflection coefficient, complex reflection coefficient, times E minus IKX. But it could be reflected from the second layer, then that would give this term RE minus 2IKA because there is additional pass, which is 2A. Or from the third layer, that would be E, additional term would be E minus 4IKA, and so on. Depending from which layer your incident light gets reflected, they all will be added up, and the final reflected wave or reflection coefficient would be given by this geometrical progression, which is easy to sum up. As first by done by Gauss when he was 9 years old. No, I was 7 years old, I forgot. So, and you would obtain this result. And the beauty of this, you can see then when E minus 2IKA is equal to 1, reflection becomes infinite, meaning that light doesn't propagate through such structure. So that's exactly the essence. That's exactly why we have these energy band gaps, because of the Bragg reflection. At some particular conditions, light cannot propagate through this structure. That's why you have energy band gap. You have a gap, meaning that light cannot propagate. Light cannot exist at these frequencies because of this Bragg reflection. And this Bragg reflection is simply interference of scattering of light scattered from different layers of your periodical structure. So you have many layers, light can be scattered from any of these layers, and because of the interference of light scattered from different layers, you have certain condition, which is called Bragg condition, where light cannot simply go inside of these crystals. That would mean that your frequency is sitting exactly within the energy gap. Okay, that's the idea. If light cannot go through, then the frequency is within the energy gap. So the Bragg reflection, that's the physics behind these energy gaps in photonic crystals. The same true, of course, about electrons and semiconductors. But in that case, we should think of electrons. It's also same thing, but about electrons. Here we think of photons. In that case, that's the same thing is occurring for electrons. So light cannot propagate in a crystal when the frequency of the incident light is such that the Bragg condition is satisfied. And this is the origin of the photonic band gap. Very important conclusion for today's lecture. And finally, I'd like briefly remind you or introduce, for those who is not familiar, the idea of reciprocal lattice, which is important for description of photonic crystals. So the reciprocal lattice vector G is defined in such a way that e to the power I j dot product A, where A is the vector describing direct lattice, is equal to zero. A describes the direct lattice. A is any lattice vector of the crystal, or let's say direct crystal lattice. And G is reciprocal lattice. So in by definition, this vectors B, which form the basis in the reciprocal space, I introduce through these formulas. And any reciprocal lattice vector G now can be defined in terms of these basis vectors B1, B2, B3, defined through these formulas, where N1, N2, N3 are simply arbitrary integers. All right, summary. Photonic crystals are artificial media with a periodic index contrast. When I say periodic index contrast, I mean that we have certain periodical structure which have refractive index different from the refractive index of your host medium. Such as, for example, if you have roads made of semiconductor, silicon or gallium arsenide, aluminum, whatever, then you have a periodical structure of contrast in terms of the refractive index, because the refractive index of these roads is different from the refractive index of your host medium, which is could be air, for example. So you have periodically modulated refractive index. Or in other words, you have periodically modulated dielectric permittivity in space. It's the same thing in the case of crystals. We have periodically modulated potential for electrons. Epsilon has the role of potential for electromagnetic modes, same role as V is played for electrons in the case of electronic structures of crystals. Electromagnetic wave in a photonic crystal is described by a band structure which relates the frequency of modes to wave vectors. This is the band structure. Okay? When we plot frequency, which because of the scale invariance, we simply consider describe in terms of C over A, where A is the lattice period. If we plot it against the wave vector, which is 2 pi over A, A is the lattice period and plays the role of the wavelengths. And remember that we can always rescale the problem for any wavelengths because it is scale invariant. And the key thing is this energy gap, because if you have energy gap, it means because of the Bragg reflection, electromagnetic modes cannot propagate in such a photonic crystals. And then the trick, you create defect through which where mode can exist. And then you can make waveguides, cavities, and many other very interesting things. So defects is exactly what brings functionality into photonic crystals. First, you need to have a band gap, and then you need to introduce defect. And that's the way to introduce functionality into your photonic crystal. And fundamental properties of modes is I mentioned scale invariance and orthogonality, meaning that different electromagnetic mode distribution are orthogonal, normal to each other. When you take this scalar product, it gives you zero. Yes, what's your question?
Are the three branches on the upper, above the band gap, are those different polarizations of waves?
No, it's not necessarily. There could be different polarization. In this particular case, it's just three different modes for the same polarization. So, but that's actually a relevant question because it also can depend on the polarization. The band structure does depend on the polarization of light. So we will mention it later in the course.